This is Jeff Blankford. My guest today, Major Danny Sherson, is quite unusual, an active U.S. Army officer who has raised many critical questions about the role and responsibility of America's armed forces and those who command them. Major Sherson is a U.S. Army strategist and former history instructor at West Point who served tours with reconnaissance units in Iraq and Afghanistan and currently lives with his wife and four sons in Lawrence, Kansas. He has written a memoir on critical analysis of the Iraq War titled Ghost Riders of Baghdad, Soldiers, Civilians, and the Myth of the Surge, and most recently for Tom Dispatch, with the most provocative title, Worth Dying For, When It Comes to the War in the Greater Middle East, Maybe We're the Bad Guys. Welcome, Major Danny Sherson, to Takes on the World.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to talk to you today.
Well, I'm really glad to have you. Well, quite apart from the provocative title of your article and the home truths and questions that you raise about U.S. military actions, not only that this century, but before that, I have to say that, well, doing so on active duty takes a remarkable amount of courage, and I salute you for that. And we're going to talk about what propelled you to take such a risky step, but how do you get away with it?
Well, one of the ways I get away with it is the disclaimer that's usually at the top or bottom of my articles and that I usually will start my interviews with, which is, you know, I speak in an unofficial capacity based on my own opinion, and I don't reflect, I can assure you, the policies and positions of the Department of Defense or the Army. I do have some legal right as a citizen, believe it or not, to speak, and it's risky, and I've been counseled by senior officers and public affairs officers that I really should be careful and consider the potential detriment to my career. But I will say this, after 12 years and 12 and a half years on active service and 4 years at West Point before that, I think we've come too far and gone too far down the road of senseless, unending war for me not to speak out. And in fact, regardless of the risks, I'm ashamed that more of my peers on active duty are not willing to speak out on behalf, if nothing else, of their men who've been lost.
Well, you have written a very compelling story, which begins in a personal relationship or view of one of the privates under your command. From there, you go on to explore and take apart the U.S. military's role in the last several decades. But what forced you, what propelled you to actually begin criticizing the military while still on active duty?
I think when I left Afghanistan in January of 2012, I left with a heavy heart. I had lost more soldiers in addition to the soldiers I'd already lost in Iraq years earlier. And I couldn't say that we had achieved much more than fighting on behalf of our mates. I couldn't say that American policy in southern Kandahar province, at least in my district, was having any real effect. The corruption that I saw, the endless cycle of repeating the same mistakes, tour after tour, at that point 11 years into a war that's now nearly 17 years old, I was accepted while I was in Afghanistan for the rare assignment to go back to graduate school and then teach in the history department at West Point. It's a very selective assignment. I was honored to get it. And that was the decision that kept me in the Army, quite frankly, or I might have left. During that time in civilian graduate school, I began writing the memoir on what I thought were the lies and the myths of the Iraq War. That was my first experience really questioning policy while on active duty. From there, I really haven't stopped. And quite frankly, things have gotten worse. So I made the decision in close coordination with my wife that, look, I feel that I need to speak out about this. And if it hurts me, it hurts me. But I owe it to myself and to the soldiers that have sacrificed themselves in these wars. That was the impetus to start. And that was 2013 when I really started putting pen to paper on the book, and I haven't stopped. You know, this year, since January 1st, I think this is my 17th article, and they're getting ever more personal, and I think this one has picked up some buzz, but I'm not stopping anytime soon, whether I'm in the uniform or not.
Well, the personal, the positions you've come from as someone who's been on active duty and has seen the war in Afghanistan and Iraq up close and seeing men die, and then the question is, what did they die for? And I have long noted that it's difficult to find any war the United States has fought and since World War II that would be defined as defending our country. How would you look at that?
I look at it the same way. I speak to my children at the table all the time. You know, we have little history lessons, and I ask them, when was the last time the United States fought a righteous war? When was the last time the United States fought a moral war? And we debated this at the table, and I made the provocative statement, and I've made it in my classrooms as well, that what if the last righteous war, what if the last necessary war was World War II? Well, if that's true, and I believe it is, that raises a lot of questions about the last 60 years of what I believe is best titled as American Empire and American folly and interventions around the world, whether it was misunderstanding the nature of communism, and that led, of course, to Korea, Vietnam, as well as numerous other CIA interventions, or our response to 9/11, which I have argued in previous pieces, should have been looked at as an intelligence and law enforcement mission that we immediately defined as a war. And the problem, whether it's on the streets of Chicago in the drug war, or it's in the streets of Baghdad in the war on terror, quote unquote, when you call something a war, very quickly, everyone's going to start running around and acting like warriors. And I would argue that that has been counterproductive. And whether it's our domestic policies regarding immigration and travel bans, or our foreign policy regarding drones and the unqualified support for Saudi Arabia and Israel, we take numerous counterproductive stands that have only made the world a more dangerous place for American soldiers, but quite frankly, also for civilians around the world who are very rarely thought of by American citizens.
Well, you just brought up Israel and the Saudi Arabia, and you, in your article, you talk about the allies who are our allies in the Middle East, and your scathing remarks about all of them. This, as also you point out, is seen by civilians around the world in a way that Americans don't even possibly contemplate or much care about, frankly.
Absolutely. Americans seem certain, whether it's through apathy or genuine belief, I don't know what's scarier. Your average American seems certain that we are the greatest force for good in the world. And by no means do I think we are the most awful country in the world or that we always have nefarious motives. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is from the perspective of the average Arab or Pashtun or African on the streets of their cities, when polled, they often list the United States, Israel, and a number of other states as the greatest threats to world peace. Now, whether they're right or wrong, the fact that millions upon millions of people feel that way around the world ought to lead us to question our own policies. Because even from a strategic perspective, leaving the morals behind, if this is truly a counterinsurgency, if this is truly a global counterinsurgency, as we've been told, then we need to win the hearts and minds. And we're losing those. We're losing those hearts and minds. America is not seen any longer, if it ever was, as the greatest force for good in the world on the Arab street. That I've seen personally. And there are numerous polls, some of which I cited in the article, that speak to that.
Well, it's also, you could say this is bipartisan. Both President Obama and President Bush and President Trump and President Clinton and so on all say we're an indispensable nation, that we're the force of good. Our secretaries of state have said that without the United States, there would be chaos in the world. But I can't see any more chaos than what the United States created with the invasion of Iraq or beginning with Afghanistan. Would you say the same?
I agree with you 100% there. One of the scariest aspects of the obtuse American approach to foreign policy is that we constantly create a cycle where we state, well, there's violence in the world, and because there's anti-Americanism and there's violence, that requires more military solutions from us. But then those very, quote, solutions end up sowing more chaos, creating more enemies, and furthering the cycle for intervention. It's a path to perpetual war. And something I want to bring up, and I think I've written an article in the National Interest on this a number of months back. Today in the Senate, Rand Paul, Republican, and Elizabeth Warren, Democrat, are actually putting forward a bipartisan bill to update the AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force. I think that's a great thing, and very few people in the Senate have the courage to talk about it. But we've been fighting the wars, whether they're in Yemen, Somalia, Syria now, Iraq, Afghanistan, under an authorization for military force, which is not a declaration of war, but an authorization of military force after 9/11. And now we're fighting groups that not only had nothing to do with 9/11, but in the case of ISIS, did not exist at the time 9/11 was perpetrated. In fact, ISIS forms in the jails of America within Iraq. At least al-Baghdadi, their leader, did, and many other key leaders. We didn't mean to form ISIS, but the sowing of chaos in Iraq through invading under false pretenses destabilized the regions and created the very conditions that set us on a forever war. That, from a legal perspective and from the responsibility of Congress, I say they need to step up and either declare war or reauthorize the AUMF with more limited terms. As Bill Belichick would say, do your job. And that's how I feel about it.
Well, it's interesting. The United States simply does not recognize the sovereignty of any other country. We have soldiers in Syria. The Russians were invited in, but the U.S. has forces in Syria that were not invited there. But nobody in the United States, at least publicly in Congress elsewhere, questions that. And with the Obama administration, we expanded the number of our special forces throughout the continent of Africa. Most Americans don't know about it, and frankly, they don't seem to care.
They do not seem to care, sir. And I have a lot of opinions as to why that is. I think the most dangerous one is that American apathy on foreign policy is driven by the lack of national service. I believe we should only be fighting when there is a vital strategic threat to the United States homeland, and it makes it a lot more difficult to hold to that line when the people are not touched by these wars. Walk around New York City and find me a soldier on active duty. Walk around L.A. and find me one. It's very difficult to do. I'll tell you where the soldiers are. They're in isolated bases in the middle of Kentucky and Texas and Kansas, where I've been. The soldiers are not reflective of the society at large. The American people no longer have any skin in the game. Why should they care whether we have 500 or 5,000 soldiers in Syria? And oh, by the way, the Trump administration has told us they're no longer going to tell us how many soldiers are in Syria. We're no longer going to have that level of clarity. But why should the American people care? It's not their sons going to war. It's a small percentage of volunteer professionals. I believe that the American people hide behind yellow ribbons. They hide behind thanks for your service and increasingly militaristic displays at NFL halftime shows. They hide behind those superficial aspects of support, and they obviate their duty to pay attention to foreign policy. This is the American people, and this is the congressional representatives who speak in their name. And it's a tragedy. And it's a tragedy that is a formula for never-ending war for my soldiers and for the victims around the world.
Amen. I pointed out that probably one of the greatest crimes that President Nixon committed was to end the military draft, which deflated the anti-war, anti-Vietnam War movement at the time. And certainly, I have told students in this area that if there was a military draft, they would pay attention to what was going on. Today, unless you have a member of your family or a friend in Afghanistan or Iraq, you have no idea and care less about what's going on there. And if students, if they're boys and girls, 17, 18, were facing the possibility of going to war, they would be questioning, they would know what was going on. There'd be an anti-war movement like there was during Vietnam, which helped to bring the war to a close. But the way things are going now, these wars, even though the military says they're going to go on forever, that we have to be in Afghanistan forever, and they're comparing it to troops being stationed in Korea or in Germany, as if the troops in Korea or Germany are being fired on by Germans or Koreans. What do you say to that argument?
You know, the National Security Advisor, who's a very intelligent individual, H.R. McMaster, has been quoted as saying that this is a generational war. Now, whether he's an intelligent man and whether I like his books, I do on both counts think those things. I think that's a very disturbing statement, generational war. Now, we have to look at Afghanistan or the war on terror as generational, because that is a formula for never-ending war. You mentioned the draft and Nixon's decision to end the draft. Very fascinating that it was Richard Nixon, of all people. Has there ever been a more cynical and pessimistic political operator? I'd say there's been few. This is what I'll say about the draft. Eliminating the draft was a tragic decision that suited all the parties involved. Let me explain that. three different parties really like the idea of getting rid of the draft, despite the consequences we're living with today. Number one, the American people. They didn't want to be drafted. They didn't want to fight foreign wars. Your average American citizen was not interested in national service. So it suited the anti-war movement in that sense because they didn't want to be drafted. Number two, it suited the military itself. The military prefers professional volunteers. When it takes a broad swath of American people, it deals with more disciplinary issues, it deals with more dissent, and it's harder for the military to train those soldiers. Now, I don't think that's a good reason to get rid of the draft, but military officers absolutely love the idea of a professional force. If you mention the draft to a professional military officer, especially a general officer, they will laugh you off. That's the last thing they want. And finally, and most nefariously, the political hawks, the war hawks, especially on the right, but not only on the right. They like the idea of getting rid of the draft because it eliminated dissent. As you said, and I think it's an amazing point you made, sir, is the anger we saw in Vietnam does not exist today. I would argue, along with you, the large reason for that is because the people do not have skin in the game. They're not worried about their own sons, exactly, daughters, and fathers being in this fight. So it took the gas, took the air right out of any sort of anti-war movement, which is why today the anti-war movement is considered a group of kooks who don't get a lot of attention. Don't draw a lot of media attention. We're so busy fawning over the latest tweet of the day that there's really no time to pay attention to the nascent anti-war movement, which I would argue should be larger and should be center stage in American political discourse.
Amen to that. I've actually argued with people about the military draft because I've talked to students about it. What exactly happens in their own personal life, and now they go from smartphone, they text, they tweet, and what goes on around them and around the world, they're totally unconscious of, and really don't, except for a minority, don't really care about it. It's really a sad thing. But there's another thing that also. We have a military culture in our society. We read about families, grandfather, the father, everyone has served in the military. And this seems to be an honor, but again, the idea that America is under attack or is actually threatened, for example, the Taliban never threatened even verbally to attack the United States, even offered to turn Osama bin Laden over to George Bush if Bush would show some kind of evidence that bin Laden was involved with 9/11. And then I've mentioned people forgotten before 9/11, Colin Powell had given what amounts to chump change, $40 million to the Taliban, and had them destroy the opium crops in Afghanistan, and they did. And then now, as you probably saw over there, Afghanistan opium, the crops are every year record-breaking. Perhaps you're coming on that.
We never seem to be able to decide whether we're going to destroy the crops or allow the people to grow them so that they can pay their defense money to the Taliban. We've gone back and forth on that, sometimes within the very single tour. When I was in Afghanistan, we changed our mind. I was given different guidance on whether to destroy the opium crop or allow the opium crop to flourish. I was given contradictory guidance on that at least three times in the course of 1 year.
You know, my guest, by the way, Major Danny Sherson, who's stationed at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas. We're talking about his article that he wrote for Tom Dispatch called Worth Dying For When It Comes to the War in the Greater Middle East, Maybe We're the Bad Guys. A very bold title. And as you go through this article, which is available on Tom Dispatch, I recommend all of you to read it. You know, one thing was interesting. After the Vietnam War was over, Americans were suffering from a disease. They called it Vietnam Syndrome. And this is because Americans were so tired of war, they had to wait till 1991 in order to send U.S. troops abroad, which was when Saddam Hussein, who had been our ally against Iran, invaded Kuwait. But maybe you could talk about this military culture. In your own family, were people in the military?
So I'm an exception in the fact that I'm not from a military family. My grandparents were, one was in the Navy and one was in the Army, draftees and volunteers, respectively. But there's no military service in my family during the Vietnam War. I have one cousin who was a sergeant in the Army, but I was the exception. My decision to go to West Point, my interest in the Army was was an anomaly within my family, but when I arrived at West Point at age 17 in July of 2001, just 2 months before 9/11, I found quickly that the military officer corps is by and large composed of a warrior caste. Caste, C-A-S-T-E, a group of people who their fathers are West Pointers or served, their grandfathers. My roommate, an amazing warrior named Logan Collins, he is the fifth generation of his family to go to West Point. His great-great-grandfather fought in the Spanish-American War after graduating. This is very common in the officer corps. The vast majority of Americans are untouched by the war, and a small warrior class, a warrior caste, you could even say, is conducting this fight. As much as I honor the service of my peers, as much as I respect the decision to serve the nation, I'm not certain that that's a healthy style of national service. Our founding fathers, who could agree on very little, we must note, were largely concerned about professional standing armies. They were concerned about what militarism and professionalized forces would do to the republic. They weren't certain that republicanism with a small r could survive a militaristic culture surrounded by a standing army. I wonder if we've gone so far down the road of this military culture you're talking about that perhaps it's too late. Most people watch what goes on before an NFL game and they watch the enormous flag, the enormous symbol of nationalism on the field, the dozens of soldiers from the National Guard, from the Army, the Air Force, the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard. And most people are extraordinarily pleased by this. When I look at it, I say, you know, that's a whole lot of militarism for a sporting event. And it's not just on Veterans Day anymore. It's not just on Memorial Day anymore. It's every day. And for most Americans, they love those displays of militarism. They love to discuss supporting the troops and how much they love soldiers, but they don't know what's going on in Syria. They don't demand to know how many soldiers are on the ground and whether they're engaging in direct combat. I would much rather people pay attention, vote, and express opinions on our foreign policy than to thank me or slap a yellow ribbon on their car, because to me, that is an empty gesture as opposed to actual political activism.
Well, empty gestures seem to be one of our national pastimes, making them, particularly the putting out all the flags along the streets on Veterans Day, flag waving ceremonies. It gets really noxious. And then when you realize every day, on the average of 22 servicemen commit suicide. Something that doesn't get discussed very much. It's small items in the paper. It's not discussed in the halls of Congress. And the number of soldiers coming back who might have been killed otherwise, but now have PTSD, that also is pushed to the side. There doesn't seem to be an end to it. And now, in you're on at Fort Leavenworth, and I asked you about how the Army was responding to you. But how about your fellow officers? How do they respond to you? Yeah.
In the history department at West Point, which is a den of scholars and an exception within the Army, while not all of my peers agreed with my political and foreign policy stances, there was a degree of collegial respect and intellectualism there. But this is what I would tell you. That is the exception in the United States Army, which, despite all of its rhetoric, continues to have an anti-intellectual posture that is very old. Most, though not all, of my peers are wildly conservative members of a partisan political right. And my opinions and my questioning of war policy is often seen by some as, if not wrong-headed, perhaps even unpatriotic, if not treasonous. So I get a lot of attacks and a lot of trolling from a lot of military veterans, especially a lot of officers. And that's not a surprise, given, I've been doing this for 16 and a half years. I have some familiarity with who makes up our officer corps. There's a lot of incredible people, but there are some very close-minded thinkers who are not quite pleased. I'll ask you this. It would be to name another active duty officer who is writing on the topics that I am in any major national publication. I can't think of another one. And the reason I say that is not to make myself sound exceptional, but because I genuinely wish there was. So I had someone to talk to. So I had someone to agree with and to build on their work. But you cannot really find another active duty officer speaking on these issues. Number one, it would not be good for your career. It's not a good idea if you're looking for a general officership. And number two, it really goes against the political instincts of the vast majority of our warrior caste. At least that's what I found in my own experience.
It's interesting. I worked with Vietnam vets after the Vietnam War and during the Vietnam War, and many of them came out and became important public speakers against the war. It was a very important part of the anti-war movement. The GIs, the Marines who had served in Vietnam and came back to speak out against it, like Ron Kovic and others. But you don't see this with vets coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, other than yourself being that exception. I remember actually at an anti-war protest in Los Angeles back in 68, a group of sailors, Marines, and members of the Army marched in uniform onto this park, MacArthur Park in Los Angeles. They were on duty and they were protesting against the war by their presence. It was quite remarkable. But you just don't see that anymore. And again, the indifference of most young Americans, unless they have a member of their family over there. I also notice that during the Iraq and Afghan wars, I look at the statistics of the dead, and I see most of the young men come from small towns.
Absolutely.
Pardon?
Absolutely, that's true.
And some do that because it's the only choice they really have to get away from the town and to get a career. And how valid is that?
It's very valid. There's been a number of political science studies showing how the Midwest, the Far West, and the American South are overrepresented among our soldiers, and the Northeast and the West Coast are underrepresented. That's statistically, empirically true. From an anecdotal standpoint of my career, I didn't have any soldiers from New York City besides myself. I grew up in Staten Island. They were from small towns in Georgia. There's an enormous amount of Texans, mostly smaller towns, many of them post-industrial towns. That's who's fighting our wars. And one of the reasons I think a lot of military, especially officers, don't speak out and don't express their right as a citizen is because, well, the military is a very steady job with surprisingly good pay for officers. I mean, no one's getting rich, but the military welfare state is strong. One of the great ironies is most of my peers who are extraordinarily partisan right-wing politically love their socialized health care, which is provided by the military, and really love their 20-year service pensions, which almost no other job has anymore. Now, I think that the military deserves that, but it can stand in the way of honest discourse because it's risky. It's risky to put your future and your family's future at stake. And the military as a profession is a welfare state, like any other government service. And out on the outside, it's much more difficult. It's much more difficult to find a job with a steady pension and an excellent health care. I don't even remember the last time I paid a copay for my children or for my medication. It's a great system, but I think that sometimes stands in the way of honest discourse.
Well, it brings up a bit of hypocrisy, and you talk about our hypocrisy. In your article, you have a section on you call boundless hypocrisy, that what we have done around the world, that we're you say we're a nation of believers, you say, but it's clear that most of us still cling to the idea that our country is a beacon of hope for the planet. Never known for our collective self-awareness, we're eternally aghast to discover so many elsewhere find little insincerity in the promise of U.S. foreign policy. And you go through that. It's quite interesting. Also, you speak about Guantanamo and what that means. And I pointed out before I called you that here we are 16 years after 9/11, and there isn't even a whiff of a hint that those who are accused of masterminding the events of 9/11 will ever be brought to trial. It's like it's a non-story at this point. And many Americans still have serious questions about the events of that day, although it's a topic that, again, it can't be discussed. We had the Saudis in the planes, and Saudis then flown back after the events went off. There are a number of questions about that, but you talk about the Saudis as an ally. Perhaps you could comment on that.
Saudi Arabia is a problematic country and a problematic ally. This administration seems very comfortable with autocracies, and so the Saudis and now the Egyptians under their military dictator seem like wonderful partners. It's not just a Donald Trump problem, of course. Even the Obama administration, the Bush administration before him, and quite frankly the Clinton administration have been remarkably close to the Saudis. That has something to do with oil, of course. It also has a lot to do with the arms trade. America is the number one purveyor of arms in the world. The Saudis buy many of them. Saudi Arabia, an interesting country. Women can't drive. Sorcery is still punishable by death. Beheadings in the streets. It's funny, it's more organized than Saudi Arabia, but a lot of the things that happen in Saudi Arabia under the guise of legality are not much different from what's happening in Raqqa with ISIS. Of course, when they do it, it's terrorism, and it's barbaric, and when our Saudi allies do it, it seems, well, that's acceptable. We have to deal with that. Saudi Arabia has funded an intolerant brand of Wahhabi Islam across the greater Middle East for at least 40 years. There are a lot of questions about the role of Saudis on those planes. There were no Afghans, and there were no Syrians, and there were no Iraqis on the planes that crashed into the buildings in my city that tore my neighborhood full of firemen apart. No Iraqis. No Syrians, no Afghans. The very people we're killing, the very people I fought against, none of them on the planes. Plenty of Saudis, 15 out of 19. And it raises a number of questions. What does it say about the United States? Is it not hypocritical to support Saudi Arabia's war against civilians in Yemen, cholera outbreak, famine, all the while we refuel their plane? Supporting the Saudis despite evidence that they're supporting intolerant groups across the Middle East, specifically in Syria, where they support the al-Nusra Front, which is a branch of al-Qaeda. Very few questions asked about this, but that boundless hypocrisy, as I called it, may not be apparent to Americans, who are amazingly able to ignore such things, but it is not lost on the people of the Middle East. It is not lost to a Palestinian walking on the West Bank today. He knows. It's not lost to most of the citizens walking around Baghdad and my old haunts. But to Americans, it's lost upon us. To see the Saudis as anything but a nefarious force in the Middle East is absolute, is just absolutely false. And so that's what I say about the Saudis. And it goes further than that. It goes further than the beheadings in the street. If you look at the refugee situation, Sweden, Canada, Turkey, all these countries are taking in exponentially more refugees than the United States, despite the fact that the United States was much more directly involved in destabilizing the region and creating the conditions for the refugees in the first place.
Exactly.
While Americans are fully comfortable with that, especially Donald Trump supporters, the people in the Middle East see right through it. They look at us and say, what hypocrites. And the fact that we can't see it it's almost breathtaking, sir, I'll tell you.
Well, you raised a number of issues, and I can understand the frustrations on your part because you've seen it up close. People read about the Saudis. Then we have, of course, you also talk about the Egyptian government, which came to power through a coup and started mowing down the opposition, literally, where there's absolutely no freedom of speech. You talk about the Israeli situation, which the Palestinians live essentially in penal colonies. Our allies, do we have any close allies who actually have any kind of moral standing in the world? The British were right with us in Iraq. Matter of fact, they even had four investigations about how we got into Iraq. And when Obama became president, the first thing he said, we have to look forward, not backward. And that was effectively pardoning all those responsible for getting us into Iraq, no?
Absolutely. You know, the British have been allies with us. They've gone into some of our crusades when no one else would. But at least in the United Kingdom, there is a degree of soul-searching. There's a degree of truth and reconciliation. The left, or the anti-war left in the Liberal and the Labour parties of the United Kingdom, at least forces investigations into Tony Blair and into the United Kingdom's role. We don't see anything like that in the United States, and it doesn't matter whether a mainstream Democrat is in office or a mainstream Republican or even a non-mainstream Republican like Donald Trump. There's no degree of soul-searching. There's no degree of truth and reconciliation. We don't want to know the truth of the past. We don't want to look backwards, and we certainly don't want to indict ourselves or ever question American motives. And that's a bipartisan issue. The one thing everyone can agree on is America is a force for good in the world and the indispensable nation. We don't read Chomsky like we should. We don't take a hard look at ourselves. We are uncomfortable doing that, and any sort of mainstream discourse, you're not going to see it on MSNBC, and you're certainly not going to see it on Fox.
Major Jenny Sherson, what's one last word? We're coming down to the end of the hour. One last word for our listeners?
Absolutely. I'm just so happy to be on the show. Please, take a look at some of the articles that I've written, as well as my book. And I'll just say this last thing, which is remain active, remain a citizen. Whether you're a soldier or a civilian, you're a citizen first. You have an obligation to read and inform yourself on these things. And the best way to support the troops, the best way to support me, and more importantly, my soldiers, is to question the motives of the United States and the world and be an active citizen. With that, I just thank you so much for having me on the show.
And your articles, your Major Sherson's name is spelled S-J-U-R-S-E-N. Did I get that right?
That's right, yeah, S-J-U-R-S-E-N. Pronounced Shorson, which is ridiculous. I respond to any conglomeration of consonants. But I write regularly for Tom Dispatch, The Nation, Huffington Post. I'll continue to do so, and if you get an opportunity to check out my book, Ghost Riders of Baghdad, where I take apart the illogical war in Iraq.
I look forward to reading it myself, and I'm very glad that I saw your article, and immediately I realized I wanted to talk to you. So thanks so much for being our guest today, Major Jenny Sherson. Good luck, and stay well.
Thank you so much. You too.
Take care. Bye-bye. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.